Hebrews chapter 11, we have come as far as verse 32, where our author, and if I slip and say Paul, that's because that's my bent. You're entitled to your own. Says, and what shall I more say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, of Barak, of Samson, of Jephthah, of David, of Samuel, and the prophets. So his point is, look, you know, we've talked about faith. We've examined Abel and Enoch and Noah, Abraham and Sarah, and Isaac and Jacob, Moses, Joshua, Rahab. And he says, you know, I could go on and on and on. I could just make this 11th chapter the longest chapter in the Bible if I wanted to. What shall I say more of these others who in same manner exercised their faith? Of Gideon and of Barak, of Samson. Would you expect to see him in there? Isn't it interesting? As we journey through these snapshots, Samson, with all of his failings morally, you know, he's included here in this hall of faith, God honoring the genuine faith that he did exercise, of Samson, of Jephthah, and all of these, so human. I mean, coming down to Rahab and then starting to name these with whom we're familiar, David. And David, we love David. We love the humanness of David and all of his greatness. You know, he's a man that can stand in front of a giant as a teenager with a sling and put an entire army to flight. It's going to mention that. And at the same time, couldn't conquer his own sexual desire, his own lust when it came to Bathsheba, and just his failing as a father, as a parent, and yet his greatness as a king, and certainly the remarkable the sweet psalmist of Israel. And yet the Lord enumerates these people. He puts them before us and says, well, you know, we could go on. We could talk about the faith of these individuals. Samuel, of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms. Many of them did that. We don't have to go through all of those stories. Wrought righteousness, set things right in the kingdom and in circumstances. They obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. Samson, Daniel, we could go there. Quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. Out of weakness were made strong. Those who waxed valiant in the fight, and of course we think of David, turning to flight the armies of aliens. That's for you sci-fi people. Those are foreigners. Those are not some of the things that we see today. Maybe get that in the wrong perspective there. Women receive their dead raised to life. Life of Elijah and Elisha. And others, now, our author does something interesting here. He says, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Now, it's interesting there. He says, others of the same kind, alloy really there. And then he's going to talk about in verse 6, others, heteros, others of a different kind. Here, he's going down and he's enumerating in verses 4 through verse 35 all of those who experienced victory in their circumstances through faith. And their faith was in God. Their faith was in something that was set before them. It was the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. But in exercising that faith, other things took place. Kingdoms were subdued. Armies were put to flight. He goes through all of those things. And he said, and you know, there were others of the same kind who did not accept deliverance. They were in control of their circumstances. They had victory over their circumstance through faith that they may obtain a better resurrection. They could have, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could have bent down before the great statue, and they didn't. There were others who didn't accept deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. And they were still in control of their circumstances and the way their faith was working. They were experiencing victory over their circumstances by exercising their faith in the unseen and invisible God and His promises. And then verse 36, we come to this tremendous change, and it says, and others, now it's heteros, others of a different kind. And these are going to be those of whom the world is not worthy. And probably many of us will fit into the category that he now describes. These are those who had victory not over their circumstances, but under their circumstances or in their circumstances. Not delivered from their circumstances, but trusting and believing and enduring in circumstances that actually contradicted God's love, God's sovereignty. They were in circumstances that were unbearable. So there are others of a different kind that exercise faith. It says here in verse 36, and others of a different kind had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment through faith, it says. They were mocked and scourged. Through faith, they were bound and imprisoned. Through faith, they were stoned. They were sawn asunder. That sounds like a popular book in the Christian bookstores, doesn't it? Faith to be sawn asunder. You know, probably a tradition tells us that it was Manasseh that sawed Isaiah in half. With a wooden saw. I don't know whether that's better or worse. I mean, sawn asunder. Were tempted. Were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins. Okay, this is not Abercrombie and Fitch. This is not the carnal stuff we have today. This is not a fashion statement. Wandering around in sheepskins and in goatskins, impoverished is the idea. Being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. What a remarkable statement. We look at these men and women who through faith in God and through their circumstances in life, they experience tremendous things. And when we think of the heroes of the faith, we certainly think of Moses and Abraham and Sarah and Joshua. And yet now here comes this unnamed army in front of us. We can surmise some of those whom he may be speaking of, but he gives us this long list of people, and he says, if others of a different kind endured tremendous suffering and hardship and never saw the answer to their prayers. They never saw God's hand supernaturally deliver them. They never were set free from the pressure of the circumstances that was causing them to disintegrate and fall apart. And yet, they exercised tremendous faith, and these were individuals of whom the world was not worthy. You know, the world that looks at you and I and says, you know, you people of faith, you know, you're not worthy. God's saying, no, the world isn't worthy to have people like that in it. The world is not worthy to be a stage for people like that to live out their suffering upon. And it's interesting today, particularly, you know, we hear an awful lot today in the political argument about, you know, this and that, and wearing your faith on your sleeve, and being open, and you know, religion should be a secret thing, and shouldn't, you know, to me, it's the end of the world is coming, and Jesus Christ is returning, and the heavens are going to split open, and he's going to descend, and he's going to come and get us, and then we're going to come back, and with our white horses, his vesture, that's not a secret thing. Just not a secret thing. It's an exciting thing. And I have hope, and I have joy in difficult times, and I got it on both my sleeves, at least down to here. You know, I just... But what about in the hard days? What about in the difficult times? You know, it flies in the face of the Word of Faith movement. And please take note of that. And some of you may have suffered under the Word of Faith movement. You know, the Word of Faith movement is great as long as you're prospering and you're healthy. As soon as you get sick or you run amok financially, if their theology is correct, and it's not, but, you know, then there's either a lack of faith in your life or there's sin in your life because if you're not prospering or not. Wait a minute. What about those of whom the world was not worthy, it says here, that suffered, that were tormented, that lived in goatskins and sheepskins, that were afflicted, that were destitute. Imagine that. Of whom the world was not worthy. Paul is trying, the author is trying to encourage sufferers also. Now, particularly these Hebrew Christians, he had said back in chapter 10, he said, call to remembrance the former days in which after you were illuminated, you endured great fight of afflictions, partly whilst you were made a gazing stock, both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly whilst you became companions with them that were so used. For you had compassion on me in my bonds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your goods, knowing in yourselves that you have in heaven a better enduring substance. He is particularly saying to these Hebrew Christians of the first century that were being cut off from work, cut off from family, cut off from their homes. Imagine being driven from your home. Imagine, because of your faith, someone coming and driving you and your wife and your children out of your home. Just that, to me, is unthinkable. You know, I used to listen to my grandmother before she died, well, obviously, and... But in World War I, you know, the Russian army came in Germany where she lived, and she said it was 2 or 3 in the morning, and they were told to gather everything they could carry, and she had 11 brothers and sisters, and she said they were driven from their farm, and she said, my mother stopped us all in the kitchen and said, you remember the people on the other side of the Rhine River believe in the same God that we believe in, and she never saw some of her brothers and sisters again after that, ever. Driven out into the night, kids. Now, that was just a war. It wasn't, but imagine because of your faith, somebody showing up at your door. And Paul is trying to encourage those who are suffering these things. James is going to write, and Peter, to the diaspora, those who have been spread out through the known world, and see them as those who are sown like seed into the lost world. Yes, there was persecution in Jerusalem, and believers were driven out, but it was God's way of scattering you like seed through the known world. And he's trying to encourage them. He himself... He said, you know, Paul and Silas, he said, we despaired of life itself when we were in Asia. And he talked about the hardship he himself had experienced. And he's saying, remember that, yeah, there were those, you know, through your own heritage, you know, your own legacy as God's chosen people, as the Jews, there were many in the Old Testament who saw great things happen because of faith. But there also have been many more that have suffered and lived and died in faith, not seeing the answer to their prayers and their faith. And he says, those of whom the world is not even worthy. Now, take note of that, because I think Paul's trying to comfort the wires. Why do you think this is happening? Why do you think that's happening? Why do you think that? And Moses got out of it, and look what happened to him at the Red Sea. And every time I get to the Red Sea, I drown in the Red Sea, you know. And look at this, and look at that circumstance. Why do you think it happened to him? And why do you think? And people try to figure all of that out. To me, that's as torturous as the circumstance itself, trying to figure all of that out. And you see, here's the thing that you and I have to take note of. You can construct an equation where you say to someone, because you're living in sin and rebellion, this is what the scripture says, and if you continue to do that, you're going to end up under the chastening hand of God. And here are examples. You're sinning against God. You're living in rebellion. And he loves you too much to approve of that. So you're running out of room. And ultimately, you're going to find yourself in difficulty. You can construct that equation from the front end. But you can't look at someone who's suffering or in difficulty and say, aha, because I see them suffering, therefore, they must have done something wrong to get into this circumstance. That's what Job's counselors did. And what God is saying here, no, there are many who were right in the middle of my love and my will who were suffering and in difficulty. And we have to be careful judging people by their circumstances when we have no idea what led up to that. You know, the disciples were told to get into the boat and to go to the other side of the sea, and Jesus sent them into the storm. There are storms of correction, no doubt, but there are storms of instruction also. And we have to be careful that we don't do that, because there's a whole theology out there that's going to say to someone, oh, you're struggling financially, or there's illness in your life, you must be in sin, or there must be a lack of faith in your life. That is heretical. It's wrong. Again, I remember hearing somebody years ago on the radio and just saying, you know, oh yeah, Johnny Erickson. You know, she's just a hero to me. Johnny Erickson, sure, she does great things for God, but if she really had faith, she'd get up out of that wheelchair. You know, I just wanted to reach through the radio and grab that guy by his throat and pull him out my end and waffle him. I was in the flesh, right? It was not right. And if he'd have blamed me, I'd have denied it, and everybody would have believed me, not him. I believe in grace. I'd have repented and been forgiven. But, you know, you hear people that do that. Somebody's being tortured in an illness or a difficult circumstance in life, and they're searching their heart, and they're broken. They're saying, Lord, why? If you're all-powerful, you're on the throne, if you love me, if those things are, why am I, why the suffering? Why the, and then to have somebody come along and drop that kind of bomb on you, it just really bothers me. Some of the most remarkable people in this church and some of the most remarkable people that I know and some of the most remarkable people I've read of are people that have gone through things that are way more difficult than anything I have ever faced. I whine and complain, but I'm such a wimp. Pray for me that nothing ever happens to me. I've watched folks in our church lose children, lose spouses. I've watched folks in our church, their own body disintegrating from cancer. I know folks in our church that have seen someone in their family shot to death right in front of them. Forsaken by husbands or wives. Infidelity. Things that might send somebody to the bar or to drugs. And I've watched people in our church, and I've watched their lives, and I've watched them hold on to Jesus Christ. And I've seen their tears. And felt it's such a lack of words or anything to say, but stood back and admired the depth of their faith and trust in Jesus Christ when there was no evidence in the circumstance. How do we know he loves us when life is falling apart? In this is manifest the love of God, that he sent his Son into the world to be the propitiation for our sins. In this is manifest the love of God, that he sent his Son into the world to be the place where he would satisfy his own wrath so it wouldn't have to come on us. What greater love could there ever be? That I would punish one of my own sons while they cried out to me for deliverance. Dad, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And fire all of my anger and wrath down upon them so somebody who's at enmity with me can be forgiven. I don't know why. People ask me why, and I have to say, I don't know. But I do know. Someday we'll stand on the other side, and we will know fully, even as we've been fully known. And he says here, there are those that have endured such remarkable things. Others, they're of a different kind. They didn't see victory over circumstances through faith. They saw victory through circumstances, under circumstances. Cruel mockings and scourgings. Bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned. Think of Stephen, of course. Sawn in half. I don't know whether that's worse or a shark is worse. I mean, it was... Tempted, slain with the sword, wandered about in sheepskins and in goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains, and in dens and in caves of the earth. David did that for years. And these all, having obtained, note, a good report through faith. That's the divine estimation, a good report. I don't know, but for 12 years in school, I wanted to get a good report and never did. And I can get one now. These, having obtained a good report through faith. Johnny Erickson blows my mind. Corrie ten Boom, the things that she went through in Ravensbrück, and the German concentration camp, watching her sister die in front of her. Paul the Apostle, just the things that happened in his life. And you read in 2 Corinthians the list of those things, and you think, wow. Of course, Jesus himself, and our author is going to bring us to that point. They obtained a good report through faith. Isn't it interesting? Even Samson is getting a good report here through faith. When we read of Abraham, we don't get any of the lapses of faith in his life when he tells his Sarah to lie when they go down. You don't get any of that. Jacob, in one sentence, we hear about his faith. I mean, that's because everything else that could have been said, but that one sentence would have been trouble in the life of Jacob. I mean, just, you look at some of these, they obtained a good report through faith, and even those unnamed believers who suffered and died, that, you know, people in this world would point to them and say, they don't have faith, that's why they're dying, that's why they're sick. That's crazy. That's crazy. You know, isn't it interesting, one of the main proponents of the faith doctrines of the word of faith, who says everybody's supposed to be healed and everybody's supposed to prosper, I look at him and think, well, why do you have crossed eyes? You know, if your faith is so strong, I'm not going to name any names, but, you know, I got to hear your crossed eyes then. I'm tired of listening to this, you know, strange-looking character. These all have obtained a good report through faith. He was in the hospital a while ago, and they covered it all up, and because, of course, it wouldn't look right for somebody with his theology to be in the hospital. That's deception, isn't it? These all have obtained a good report through faith. Received not the promise, that singular, the promise, in regards to the Messiah, in regards to the kingdom, they received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. Now, Jesus said, Abraham longed to see my day, and he saw it. He rejoiced. You know, if they have Moses, if they don't believe Moses, you know, Moses wrote, and the things he wrote of testify of me. Those Old Testament saints saw Christ. They saw Messiah. They saw the kingdom. And it says, they died not having received the thing they looked for. Abraham wandered in a land of promise as a stranger and a pilgrim, looking for a city whose builder and maker was God, never received it, died in faith. And it says here, there's the whole line of believers in every age that have died that way, God having some better thing for us, that they should not be made perfect without us. In other words, if 100 years ago, believers would have received the end of their faith, the kingdom would have come. You and I would have been born. You and I would have been saved. God having some better thing. It says, these all having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. I got saved in 1972. I'm glad God waited that long. But selfish old man that I am, I wish he'd come now. You know, I'm in, so get us out of here, Lord. You know, but the truth is, there are thousands of others that will come into the kingdom. God having some better thing for them, that we, without them, should not be made perfect. Shouldn't see the end of our faith. But we're believing. Some better thing for us, certainly the new birth, certainly the new covenant, certainly faith in Christ, not complete, but more complete than what they enjoyed in the Old Testament. Wherefore, he says, now, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Wherefore, in light of all of this, seeing we also are compassed, we're surrounded about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us do two things. Let us lay aside every weight and sin. Let us run with patience the race. We're surrounded with this cloud of witnesses, he says here. Now, the word is not a witness who is observing something or looking at something. It's someone who is a witness of something to let somebody else know about that thing. In other words, we're surrounded with so great a cloud of witnesses. What does that mean? Does that mean that Abraham and Enoch and Noah and Abel and Isaac and Rahab and David and all those guys are standing around watching us, cheering us on? Come on, you can do it. Does that mean that your mom and your dad and your grandpa and Charles Spurgeon and all those who have gone before us, that right now they're standing around cheering you, you know, come on, and we're surrounded with this, and that when you do something stupid in traffic, you go, oh man, they're all watching. Or you lose your temper or have an argument with your wife or scream at your kid or scream at your parent or scream at yourself in the mirror. I don't know, you know, whatever. You know, that they're all going, oh, did you hear that? That's not what it means. Just think how crazy that whole idea is. What you're saying is heaven is so boring, all they got to do is stand around and watch us. You know what? If heaven is like that, that my relatives and friends that have gone on before me are standing around watching me, that ain't much of heaven, I'll tell you. If I'm more exciting than what's going on there, that's not, you know, I think what's going on in heaven is the glory that's in front of them. If you've lost loved ones, what are they beholding? Think of what's in their view right now. Think of what's in front of them. They are in the place that they were made for. Every color is the color that they've longed for. You know, when your wife at home says, honey, we should change. No, we need to change the color of the carpet. I do it, but I know it's futile because it's not really the color she's looking for. Then you have to change the color of the wall to go with the color of the carpet, and then the color of the clothes, the color of the drapes. You know, just, you know, when we get there, then all of a sudden we're going to see, we're going to understand what eyeballs are for, what they were meant to see of glory and of things shining and glistening and refracting and reflecting light and shining. Then we're going to understand what the most comfortable temperature is. And my wife will not be in charge of the thermostat. That'll be heaven in and of itself. Then we'll understand what ears were made for when we hear myriads, untold millions of saints and angels singing. And every voice redeemed. None of that cat with a truck on its tail singing anymore. Just everybody, you know, just imagine with those who have gone to glory and in front of their eyes is Jesus Christ in his glory with the cherubim around, you know, singing holy, holy. You think they're standing around saying, oh, this is boring. I want to watch Joe. Just think how crazy that is. No, it's not. They're not witness like that. And what he's saying is we're surrounded with this great crowd of testimonies that we just went through, that they encourage us. It doesn't say they're standing around watching us. The testimony of their lives and their faith is to be an encouragement to us. Oh, I'm too old to get started now. You don't understand what you're saying, but I can't make a serious commitment. Wait a minute. Abraham was 75 years old. Well, you don't understand. I'm 85. Well, Noah was 800. Well, I'm having troubles with my family. I have troubles at home. Well, Jacob stands up off the page and says, come on, you can do it. I had 4 wives, 12 kids. Don't tell me about your problems. I really can't put my life on the altar. Isaac said, you have no idea what it feels like to put your life on the altar. I struggle with sexual temptation. Yeah. So did Samson. So did David. They're here in front of us. The book of Hebrews exhorting the first century Hebrew Christians and us, obviously, to faith in the one. And we're surrounded with this great cloud of witnesses in every age that believed in him, that their testimony is to be an encouragement to us. That's what the grammar says here. The sufferers of other ages. Are you suffering tonight? And I know some of you are. Are you in difficulty tonight? Are you in pain in your physical frame? Are you broke, destitute, afflicted? I know that some of you are. Well, there are those who will rise up off the page and say, I believed you can believe. I believed. You can believe. It's still in front of you. The promise of God is still real. The difficulties of life have not contradicted the promises of God. They're yea and amen, and they still lay on the horizon in front of us. You know, the world is completely different than that. What do worldly people hope in? What are they after? What are they trying to get hold of? And then when they get it, it's a vapor. It's an illusion. You know, I love David says, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. One translator translates that, surely goodness and mercy shall hunt me all the days of our lives. You know, worldly men and women are out seeking good things for themselves. It says for the believer, goodness and mercy is hunting us all of the days of our lives. Seeing we are surrounded with so great a cloud of witnesses, there's encouragement there. Let us do two things. First, lay aside every weight and sin which does so easily beset us. That's the first thing. Lay aside every weight and then every sin. Two things. Every weight. We're running a race here. It just, you know, I don't know about you guys. I was glued to the Olympics while I could be. Michael Phelps. I mean, I love, you know, I felt like, oh, I shouldn't say this, but, you know, I felt like they really, you know, in the team sports, there were so many calls against us. I think, you know, Europe and the rest of the world are sick of Americans. And I, you know, just, so I love the races where it was one guy against one guy or one gal against one gal because they couldn't say nothing. Then if we won, we won. We won. Nah. But you see those, you know, the swimmers. I mean, they all got their different, you know, rubber thing on their head, I guess, to keep their hair from slowing them down. Or if they had big ears, they all have their ears, you know, pulled down over their head. And some of them have the streamlined long outfit with the stripes in it. None of them have ribs running this way. They're all streamlined. Now they study the belly of a whale. They got those ridges down. We'll put that on our bathing suit and make us swim faster. And just, you know, and they all have different. And the runners, they all have their stuff. You know, it's interesting. I love that 26-mile run. I watched that because, to me, anybody who wants to do that to themselves is insane. So I enjoy watching other people do it because it's not the race that I'm called to run. But, you know, and I knew, I watched, and the one runner from the United States who got the silver, I kept watching because I knew before the race was over he was going to knock his hat off. Because I kept looking at that hat and thinking, okay, you know, you're in Athens, you're in the middle of the day, the sun is hot, so there's some scientific, you know, you've been coached and you know, you've got this white hat on. It's not a black hat, it's not drawing the heat, it's a white hat, and it's reflecting the heat, and I know, and then there's some science here to keep you from overheating, but I'd have at least have turned it around backwards because it seems like the flap was in the back, you'd run faster, but you know, the whole time I'm thinking, that's slowing you down. But I knew somewhere before it was over he was going to throw that thing off, and I watched, sure enough, when they got close to the stadium and evening come, that hat went flying off, and I thought, I knew it. And you don't want that. The every weight is going here, you know. You know, they say that over one-third of Americans are overweight. Probably round figures, I mean, but, you know. Oh, come on. But the term used here in the Greek applied to two things. It applied to unnecessary body weight. In the Greek games, they would torture themselves to get their body fat content down. We were watching, and I don't know if you watched, they talked about one runner that ran 150 miles without stopping in less than 48 hours and dropped dead when he got to where he was supposed to go and gave the message and died. He ran 150 miles without stopping. Now, you know he wasn't carrying stuff. He didn't have hoagies under his arms, you know. His favorite dictionary in his hand. I mean, just, you know, let us cast off every weight, you know, that just you strip down to what we need to, you know, is the idea here. And it says the other thing is every sin that does so easily beset us. It's an interesting construct. It's sin that encircles us, sin standing around. Campbell Morgan, I love it, he translates it, every sin in good standing around. And the idea is, you know, this is we're running a race. Well, you know, they run a race, and Paul says they run it to receive a laurel wreath. And we saw that all through these, and it's a fading crown. And only one, you know, gets the winner, Paul says. Now, of course, now we have gold, silver, and bronze. But not in this race. In this race, everybody wins. Because who you're running against is you're running against yourself. When we start to compete with other Christians, it's just a sign that we're in the flesh and we're carnal. Because the race we run is the race that God says, which is set out before us. God's sovereignty is involved in it. Each of us has a lane. And when you're, you know, when you're in that 100 meter and 400 meter, you are in that lane. They tell them, don't look at the crowd, don't look around for other runners, because it slows you down. Just keep your eyes on your lane, and you keep your eyes on the goal. You don't take your eyes off, and you run that way. And each of us, we're running against ourselves. I want to be a better teacher. I don't want to be a funky, old, crotchety, miserable pastor. I want to be more like Jesus next year than I am this year. I want to pray more next year than I do this year. I'm running against myself. And every one of us have a lane that we run in. Every one of us has a course, it says, that's set out before us. The idea is it stretches out before us. And we're running our race. Some of us, in running our race, we're exercising faith towards God, and we're having victory over circumstances. Some of us are running our race, and we're having victory under circumstances. And for each of us, we have to lay aside every weight and every sin that does so easily beset us. The sin in good standing is some of that. When you think of stripping off every weight, it's every little thing. Every little thing that would slow you down. Because you see, some of those guys touch the wall. 1/100th of a second gives them the gold, the victory. They strip down everything. And it says, this is the race that we're running. It's a race that's set out in front of each of us as individuals. And we're running against ourselves, not against anyone else. And we have to know the weights that we carry, that we really don't need to carry. You and I have to know, first of all, sin in good standing. Oh, yeah, you know there's those big, black, terrible sins. And then there's those little, not-so-bad white sins. But when you're running a race, you want all of that off. You know, there's like sin in good standing. My son's not a murderer. She's a drink once in a while. My daughter is not a harlot. She just loves to go. You didn't know what I was going to say. She loves to go see Madonna, you know. Yeah, we stand in line to get her tickets. Wait a minute. What's your Achilles heel? You know, we wrestle in different arenas. We have different stuff. We're all individuals. God loves us that way. We're glad that we have the freedom to be individuals. But that means we do have different struggles. Some of us struggle with fear. Some of us with bitterness. Some of us with lust. Some of us with gambling. Some of us with, you know, addiction and substance abuse. You know, we all wrestle with different stuff. But we're not running against each other. So let us lay aside every weight and every sin that doth so easily beset us. And let us run with patience, that's endurance, perseverance, the race that is set out before us. God has set it. He's given us a lane. There is something that's set out in front of each of us. And that's our course. How do we do that? Verse 2 tells us how we do it. Looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher, not of our faith, of the faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest you be wearied and faint in your minds. In your minds. Isn't it interesting? Because some of us here could run a mile and some of us would drop dead at 100 meters. But there's a race we all run here. Lest you be wearied and faint in your minds, you have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. And the sin particularly of unbelief is what it's talking about here. How do we run this race? Looking unto Jesus. Now, it's interesting. It's ever looking off unto Jesus. There's a construct there. It's very interesting. Ever looking off unto Jesus. It's as though you're in your lane and you're running your race and the finish line is Jesus himself. You're not looking at Abraham. You're not looking at Moses. You know, their lives were an example to you that the race, in fact, can be run. There are those who have suffered. Johnny Erickson, Corey Ten Boom, you know, and the race can be run. You read Fox's Book of Martyrs and it says the race can be run. But who we're looking off unto is Jesus. He's both the author of our faith. It's because of him we're saved. And he's the finisher. He crossed. The finisher is he was the first to lead. It's a construction of two words. He led first. He's the pioneer. He didn't just say, I want you to do it. He did it. He didn't just come down here and exercise all of his divine prerogatives. He came as a man. He said to Satan when he tempted him, man does not live by bread alone. And he wept, and he bled, and he sweat, and he suffered, and he feared. Ever looking off unto Jesus, who was the first to finish, to cross the finish line, and is the author and the finisher. Keeping our eyes on him. Not your Jesus, my Jesus. I'm not called to keep my eyes on your Jesus. Now, I say that in this sense, okay? We all have a personal relationship with, you know, don't tell me your Jesus is one of the ascended masters, and, you know, and he's, you know, he's, has a special ministry, you know, to the Hopi Indians, or, you know, he's, you know, the same Jesus that's in the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishad. No. No, when I say your Jesus and my Jesus, I'm talking about our own personal relationship with the Jesus of the Bible, of the tribe of Judah, the Jewish Messiah, born of a virgin, crucified under Pontius Pilate, raised again, returning, the Jesus of the Bible. My race is in relationship to my Jesus. My Jesus. The Jesus that's saying to me, do it now. Isn't it interesting? The chapter 11 began by saying, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. But it is interesting that it says, now faith. And he's challenging me in my life about now faith. Not yesterday's faith, not tomorrow's faith, now faith. I know that's out of context, forgive me. But the idea is my Jesus, the one who says to me, do it now. Don't procrastinate. Don't carry this weight one more day. Cast it away. Don't let sin and good standing entangle you. And that's the idea. Cast that off. Run the race that I have set before your life with endurance, with perseverance. Ever looking to me. That's all he asks. Because he's the author and the finisher of my faith. He provides everything I need along the way. He himself has run every step. I have a high priest who can be touched with my infirmities because he suffered in every way, yet without sin. And I can come boldly to the throne of grace to receive help in time of need in this race that I'm running. Ever looking off unto Jesus, it says here, who's the author and the finisher. So look, don't tell me, well, my Jesus tells me. No. Our Jesus gave us the rule book, okay? I just saw somewhere in the news today this, and I hadn't seen it during the Olympics. Somebody got up on the high dive with some kind of a purple leotards and a little tutu, some guy, and some advertisement for something.com, and disrupted the competition and jumped off the high dive with some crazy ballerina outfit on. And now the Greeks are thinking I'm the sentencing him to prison for 5 months. And he's saying, well, I didn't think it was, you know, a big deal. I didn't think it was. Well, that's my point. Let's go back to the point, because I lost you out there with the tutu and the diving board. The point is there are rules, and you have to run the race according to the rules. It's an open book test, okay? That should put us all ahead. It's an open book test. But Paul will say, says in another place that we strive for mastery, we strive according to the rules. Don't tell me your Jesus says you can live in sin. You can live in fornication. You can go out and get drunk. You can be gambling your family's money away. You can be filled with hatred and unforgiveness. No. He's given us all the same rule book that we compete within the pages of. We do that. But my course is different. We're not competing on the same course. My course, he has a course for my. Paul said, I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. He had a course for his life. Every one of us have a course for our life. That, and it's custom made. God's sovereignty rules over it. Within the context of it, there is victory over circumstances, and there is victory under circumstances for every single one of us. Every one of us in this room will suffer. Every one of us in this room, if the Lord tarries, will die. Every one of us in this room, if God tarries, will feel the breakdown of our physical frame and be trapped within it one day and long to be set free, to be with Jesus, to cross the finish line. What I'm hoping is, because I'm an escapist, is the trumpet will blow and we'll all be out of here and we'll cross all together. That's what I'm hoping. Now, I don't think that's a bad thing. Somebody says, well, you're crazy. Well, crazy about great things. I'm crazy about Jesus. People are crazy about all kinds of stuff out there. Look at what people do. Look how they dress. Look what they spend money on. Just saw this new sports car the other day. We were watching on TV. Starts at $175,000. It don't go as fast as I'm going to go when I get my new body. I'm crazy, yeah, but everybody's crazy. I live in a world, same 6 billion people you do. They're all nuts. Just what are you crazy about? That's the important thing. Ever looking off unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of the faith, who for the joy that was set before him, he understands, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God for the joy that was set before him. And what was that joy that was set before him? You know, people try to wrestle that all around. It tells us, even Isaiah 53 said, he shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, because he will cleanse them from their iniquities. He shall see the travail of his soul. He shall be satisfied. Jude says it this way. Now unto him that is able to keep you from falling and to present you faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising shame. What was the joy? You and I. One day all in glory. Father, I will that those who you have given me be with me where I am, he says. That's the only time he says to his Father, my will. Every other place it's your will be done. The one time he exerts his own will and he says, Father, I just long for the day that they're all with me in glory and they can behold the glory that I had with you before the world began for the joy that was set before him. It's you and I. That one day he's going to take you and I and present us faultless before the throne of his Father, and he's going to say, Father, meet my bride. Meet my bride. And we won't look like we do now. Look around the room. The Father would say, are you sure? No, this corruption will put on incorruption. This mortal will put on immortality. We will be spotless and pure. We'll be perfect. And the Father will say, wow, I understand. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. It's interesting. John tells us, I think chapter 10 or 11, that Jesus was wandering in Solomon's portico in the Feast of Lights in the winter. It was winter. Wandering alone in Solomon's portico. Because within 6 months, Peter would preach a sermon there and 3,000 souls would be saved in the book of Acts. Jesus before the cross, wandering in Solomon's portico alone. The joy that was set before him. He endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of power. Set down. What more can I say? He says to us. Of Gideon, of Barak, of Jephthah, of David, Samson, the prophets, who did incredible things through faith, subduing kingdoms, putting the armies of aliens to flight. Some even refusing to be delivered, still having control of their circumstances. They might obtain a better resurrection. But then there were others of a different kind who endured cruel mockings, scourgings. They were imprisoned. They were bound. They were driven. Sheepskins, goatskins, destitute, poor, afflicted. Men and women of whom this world was not worthy, who lived and died in faith and did not see the promise. God having some better thing for us, that they, without us, should not be made perfect. Therefore, seeing we're surrounded with such a great cloud of testimonies of others who lived and died in faith, let us lay aside every weight and sin that does so easily beset us, and let us run with endurance, perseverance, the race that is set out before us as individuals, ever looking off unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy and the glory that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the Father. What a great race we're running. You know, and I'm so thankful that I get to run it with you guys. I really am. Whatever comes, whatever God has for us before this is all over, I'm so thankful that he put me in a family of believers. I'm so thankful for the family, my wife, my kids. I'm glad for you guys. We're here together. Whatever comes, comes, you know. I don't know what's going to happen. Terrorism comes and smallpox sweeps across this neighborhood. I'm glad I'm going to get spotted with you guys. If a nuke goes off out in the parking lot, I'm glad I'm going up with you guys. If something terrible happens and we all stand around going, I'm glad I get to do that with you guys. What a privilege. And what a great race we're running. And I pray that we can all be an encouragement to one another, to exhort one another, it says, while it is called today, to love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling together of ourselves, as the manner of some, but all the more being faithful to gather, to worship, to study, as we see the day drawing near. What a privilege.